Thank you, and may it please the court. I'm Stephanie Schuster, here on behalf of the appellant, Rite Aid Corporation, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
We'll keep an eye on the clock. We'll try to help you.
Thank you. California's equitable estoppel doctrine requires a non-signatory who asserts claims that rely or depend on a contract to accept that contract's burdens, including any arbitration provision and any delegation clause.
Counsel, in this case, what contract do the plaintiffs rely upon? They're seeking damages for violation of California and common law. I don't see them invoking any contractual language in connection with their alleged causes of action. So to what contract are you referring?
Sure, Your Honor. The contracts at issue are the contracts between Rite Aid pharmacies and the plaintiff's insurance companies or pharmacy benefit managers. And
but what does that have to do with it? I mean, they're claiming, if I understand it correctly, that Rite Aid committed fraud in the, if you will, the amount that they showed as usual and customary. They don't refer to the contract in terms of they're trying to get damages for breach of contract, do they?
Well, they go out of their way to avoid doing that, but in essence, they are necessarily relying on an alleged breach of the contractual obligation to make out their allegations of fraud, misrepresentation, and breach of duty, because whether the prices that Rite Aid reported were, as plaintiff contends, false and inflated necessarily turns on the pharmacy contracts and specifically what they require pharmacies to report as a usual and customary price and how they define usual and customary price, which is something that is governed and specifically defined in each of these pharmacy contracts.
Are they all defined the same way? Or because Stafford argues, I believe, that there's an industry standard, so it's well understood what usual and customary means.
They're all separately defined and differently defined, as we point out in our briefing. And if you just a comparison of the different provisions, there are similarities to be sure, but they are different and unique to each pharmacy contract. Each has different terms. And while there may in fact be an industry standard, the relevance of that standard it can only be to the proper interpretation of those contract terms. But it is the contract itself that gives rise to the alleged obligation to report usual and customary prices. The obligation that plaintiff necessarily claims that the Rite Aid pharmacies breached here as the basis for his claims in this case.
So if one of the contracts defined usual and customary as excluding the RX savings program, so by contract eliminated it, then at least with respect to that contract, he wouldn't have a fraud claim. Is that your argument? It's
certainly possible, Your Honor, but our argument is slightly different. It's that the only source of the obligation in particular, the only legal source of the obligation to report any specific price as a usual and customary price comes from the contracts. And there really isn't a dispute about that in this case. Plaintiff has conceded, though he tries to deny it on appeal, he's conceded in sworn interrogatory responses that he is, in fact, relying on the pharmacy contracts to make out his claims against Rite Aid in this case.
Where is that in the record?
That is in his interrogatory responses are response to interrogatory 6, 7, and 8 at ER 241 to 245, Your Honor. He was asked specifically to identify each contract, statute, and regulation, if any, that support his contention that Rite Aid was obligated to report any specific price, a usual and customary price, and then critically in interrogatory 8, the usual and customary price equal to the savings program price. He responded unequivocally, quote, the contracts and agreements between Rite Aid and pharmacy benefit managers will support this theory.
So does it really matter the source of the duty to report? What if it were a statutory duty or administrative duty or something like that that's independent of the contracts?
It does matter the source of the duty, because if it was, Your Honor, independent, the duty arose independent of the contracts, if the claims were fully independent of this contractual duty, then we wouldn't have an equitable estoppel argument here. But here, it's undisputed. This duty arises from the contracts, and plaintiff has conceded that he is relying on them, at least in part, and that's all that is necessary under California law for equitable estoppel to apply.
But isn't, in this situation, isn't that just more of an evidentiary circumstance of how he will prove that they made the statements and why?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think in this circumstance, he can prove the statements that were made by proving what prices were reported. But critically, he needs to prove that they were, as he says, false and inflated. And to do that requires a comparison between what was reported and what the contract required Rite Aid to report. And only if there's a deviation from the contractual obligation can the plaintiff demonstrate that these prices were false and inflated, as he contends, showing his necessary reliance on the contract terms to make out his claims.
So even if Rite Aid has no obligation at all to report usual and customary to the pharmacy managers, if Rite Aid takes it upon itself to report the usual and customary price, doesn't it have to do it accurately?
Sure, it would have to do it accurately if there were an understanding of that definition, if it took that upon itself, and it would have a duty to the insurers to do so accurately. But here, that's not this case. This case is about a specific contractual requirement to report a specifically defined usual and customary price, which the plaintiff acknowledges with those interrogatory responses. The district court misapplied California law by rejecting equitable estoppel here on the ground that plaintiff's claims do not sound entirely in contract. But under California law, a claim doesn't have to sound entirely on a contract. Reliance on contract terms, even if not exclusively, is all that is required for equitable estoppel under California precedent. The district court also exceeded its authority under the Federal Arbitration Act when it held, alternatively, that even if equitable estoppel applies, the plaintiff's claims are not arbitrable. The pharmacy contracts, all of them, delegate arbitrability disputes to the arbitrator, and neither plaintiff's status as a non-signatory, his role as a consumer, nor his level of sophistication is irrelevant or sufficient to give the court authority to decide delegated questions.
Do you have any Ninth Circuit law that backs up that proposition?
Yes. So in Brennan, this court said it was in
which case?
Brennan,
and is that the Ninth Circuit case?
That is a Ninth Circuit case where this court said, you know, our holdings should not be read to foreclose enforcing a ruling corporation delegation clause based on the consumer status or level of sophistication of the parties. Noting
well, I understand
that,
but what I'm asking is in connection with the delegation doctrine. There's some language from the Fifth Circuit, of course, that divides these into the court having the obligation to decide whether there is a contract. And then secondly, if there is no delegation doctrine, then the court has to decide who decides the entry, it acts as the gateway, basically. But if there is a delegation clause, then they don't they leave that to the arbitrator, basically. Do we have any case like that?
You do, Your Honor, but I think more importantly, the Supreme Court
What case is that? It's not Brennan.
Well, I think Brennan discusses, it certainly discusses the delegation and whether there's a delegation clause, the court can't resolve that issue. But this goes back to the Supreme Court's decisions in First Options versus Kaplan, to Rent-A-Center versus Jackson, and most recently, just a couple of years ago, in the Henry Schein case, the Supreme Court made clear that although the presumption is that courts will resolve questions of arbitrability, if the contract includes a delegation clause, the court lacks authority to decide questions of arbitrability, just as a court is not allowed to decide merits issues that the parties have delegated to arbitration, it can't decide arbitrability issues.
Have we held that applies to unsophisticated parties, or have we left that open?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, in the Brennan case, the court noted that the question, the court didn't need to resolve it in that case, but made very clear that the decision should not be read to foreclose holding that a rule incorporation delegation clause can be applied to unsophisticated parties, noting that no circuit had ever invalidated one on that ground.
And have we held that it could apply to unsophisticated parties, or have we left that an open issue?
Again, that was left as an open issue. That was left as an open issue in the Brennan case. But the three circuits that have squarely addressed this question, the Third, Fifth, and Sixth Circuits, have directly held that the level of sophistication and consumer status don't matter. And that makes sense because the Supreme Court has made very clear that the clear and unmistakable standard is a rule of contract interpretation, not a rule of the contract's formation, validity, or enforceability. It's the language that matters, not the circumstances. And for that reason, the district court should not have addressed the questions of arbitrability, including waiver and scope, in the first instance. And while we think those rulings were erroneous, neither should this court address them. But if to just add a note on waiver, if this court is going to decide to address it, notwithstanding the delegation clause, Rite Aid did not waive its right to arbitration. In particular,
wait a minute. I'm puzzled with that because you had two motions to dismiss that were litigated. You had discovery, and then you moved to compel arbitration. Isn't that more than adequate to show that you waived the issue? I mean, they would certainly be prejudiced on the statute of limitations issue, at least, would they not, if it went your way?
No, Your Honor, for several reasons. I'll start from the backwards with the prejudice. The statute of limitations issue, they got the benefit of being able to correct their complaint right. And replead.
But my point, counsel, is that if they had to go back, then would there not be a prejudice to them of having to relitigate an issue that they thought was resolved?
No, there wouldn't be prejudice to them from having to relitigate an issue that they thought was resolved on the statute of limitations ground. But more importantly,
You would concede that?
Concede what, Your Honor?
You would concede the statute of limitations issue if it were sent back?
Yes, we moved to dismiss on the statute of limitations ground. The court granted it, dismissed the complaint without prejudice, plaintiff repleaded, and there has been no further litigation on statute of limitations, so there's no issue.
But if it were to go back to the district court, not to arbitration, you're conceding that the statute of limitations issue is no longer on the table. You've conceded that.
No, Your Honor. We're not conceding that.
Okay, so then there could be prejudice
because to
Stafford.
The statute of limitations issue on the current complaint has not been litigated at all in any motion or decided.
Okay. All right. I just want to be sure you understand that from my perspective, prejudice would ensue to them if it were remanded as part of the prongs of the waiver issue.
Sure, Your Honor. Well,
do you want to save the rest of your time? By the way, you're down to 2 minutes.
Yes, I'd be happy to save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay. So, Mr. Love, I bet you don't agree with her.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Andrew Love for the plaintiff appellee, Brian Stafford. I think what's an important distinction in this case compared to the vast majority of cases that involve non-signatory defendants that are seeking to compel arbitration against a signatory plaintiff, this is one of those very rare cases involving a non-signatory plaintiff. And here, the plaintiff didn't sign the contract, hadn't even seen the contract before filing the complaint, and could not have because it was confidential. And so Rite Aid here seeks to break new ground. They don't cite any case where equitable estoppel applies in the non-signatory context where the plaintiff had not seen the contract. They rely on JSM Tuscany versus Superior Court, which is where the Court of Appeal first addressed the issue of a non-signatory plaintiff. I believe the only one in California that actually found equitable estoppel applied. And there, what the court held in this context was that the claims, not only did the claims have to be based on the failure to perform under the contract, but also, importantly, there was a pre-existing relationship between the non-signatory plaintiff and other parties to the contract. The court said that was particularly germane to the finding of equitable estoppel in the non-signatory plaintiff context. The only other case that defendants cite with regard to where a non-signatory plaintiff was held bound is an unpublished case of this court, Steiner versus Brooksdale Senior Living, where again, the plaintiff son was the one who signed the contract, and specifically the complaint was based on the failure to perform under the contract.
What are the elements of Mr. Stafford's claim if we eliminate the contract obligation of Rite Aid? So if there is no contract, how would you define his claim?
His claims are based, as a district court found, without relying on the contract, without relying on contract obligation.
So what are the elements? What is the claim, and how does he satisfy the elements of that claim?
Let's see. So the claim is that, you know, there's a duty under independent sources of the contract from industry standards and California consumer law, which prohibit a deceptive practice or misrepresentation in the commercial setting. And that's the element of the California consumer laws. Without reference to the contract, it's a misrepresentation, knowing misrepresentation.
So who's misrepresenting to whom, based on your theory, without the contract?
So Rite Aid has essentially created this scheme of a two-tiered pricing system. And so where they have not reported as usual and customary prices, lower prices from the RX savings program. And by doing that, it over...
That's not reported to the PBM. Exactly. And what's their obligation to report to them? It's not the contract.
It's, as the district court found, under industry standards. And in fact, the NCPDP creates these standards. There was a required form that the pharmacies have to... that Rite Aid has to fill out with the usual and customary pricing, and it's under these obligations which they failed. And then the prices were the overinflated prices was a misrepresentation and a deceptive practice under California consumer law.
So without any contract with these pharmacy managers, industry standard, I'm not sure what that means in this context, but every pharmacy sales company, you know, Rite Aid or CVS or whatever, would on their own report to the managers.
Exactly.
So there's no need for the contracts, is what you're saying. Is that the theory?
That is the theory. That the district court plausibly held that the allegations under that theory were plausibly pled. And so here's under California law, if claims could be fully viable without reference to a contract, which the district court found, equitable estoppel doesn't apply.
Let me ask you this, though. As you know, Ms. Schuster indicated that in your answers to, I believe she said, the interrogatories, that you answered positively that you were relying on a certain number of contracts. Do you dispute that?
Yes, very much. So the interrogatory asked what contracts and other sources support the claims. Rite Aid says support under the Webster's dictionary definition means provide a basis for. Well, that's not the only definition of support. If you look at Webster's, there's an alternate definition, even higher in the list, which is to substantiate or to corroborate. And I think what's important is the full answer to this interrogatory, asking, you know, to identify contracts supporting Rite Aid's obligations, included many more contracts. It was a broad, this is at ER 242. It wasn't just the contracts between Rite Aid and the PBMs and the TPPs. It was also contracts with PBMs and employers, unions, and government entities. And it just can't be the case that when plaintiff answered this interrogatory, it meant that all of these various contracts, were the basis for his claims.
So is the term usual and customary price legally enforceable then? If you're not relying on a contract, I know you're talking about common law, you're talking about our consumer protection law, 17,200, but how does usual and customary pricing then become legally enforceable?
It's legally enforceable because under the California consumer laws, Rite Aid was obligated not to engage in deceptive practices and not to misrepresent not to make misrepresentations in a commercial setting, which is precisely what they did.
But it's like you're saying they're Joe and Sally, and they have a contract between them, and Joe falsely made certain statements to Sally. I wasn't part of that contract, but I want to rely on that misstatement for my own claim. How does that work?
I think the difference here is we're in a commercial setting, and under California consumer laws, their business is required not to misrepresent, not to engage in this deceptive scheme where consumers are then, you know, paying more for their copayments.
So bottom line, from your perspective, because you claim that Rite Aid deceived these pharmacy managers, and because your client allegedly got product that was overpriced as a result of that, that's all you need under California and common law, right?
Yes.
Do you have a case that best substantiates that position?
I think the closest cases are Kramer versus Toyota, and from this court, 705 Fed Third 1122, and also Murphy versus Direct TV, 724 Fed Third at 1231, and also in a footnote in Murphy where it talks about how equitable estoppel is particularly inappropriate when plaintiffs seek protection of consumer protection laws that are not intimately related with the contract.
Well, I get your point about equitable estoppel. My question was kind of back to, I think, Judge Yakuta's question. You got to have a duty somewhere, and you're not part of the contract, you're saying. You're saying your client was cheated, but yet the contract that set the price, from your perspective, is you're not part of it. It seems quite random. I mean, I could almost pick anybody out in the neighborhood where they had a contract dispute, and if I bought from their store, I could say, you know, they didn't, you know, they breached their supply contracts, and I'm entitled to relief.
Well, again, these claims are independent of any contract. It has to do with, we have a consumer who's paying more than they should have because of these deceptive practices. And I would point the court to the district court's denial of the motion to dismiss at ER 69, where it kind of lays out how Rite Aid owes this duty because they're conveying pricing information in a commercial setting. And they have this duty to report the information accurately. And that although there are these various sources of this duty, that they include the industry standards, and that the complaint plausibly alleges California consumer violations without reference to the contract.
And can I ask just about the complaint? I recognize that in paragraph 52 of the complaint, it references Rite Aid tried to avoid complying with its contractual obligations and accepted industry standards, and then goes on to mention federal and state law. But where in the complaint is the best explanation of your theory that Rite Aid had an obligation under industry standards to report these prices to the PBMs and failed to do so? Because that seemed to be the one place that actually references industry standards.
Also, I think it's ER 91 through 92, paragraphs 28 through 31, where it talks about the NCPDP setting industry standards. I think what was critical was the standardized form that was required to be filled out and to report the usual and customary prices. And so there, and then a definition of usual and customary prices from the NCPDP, which sets out both the standard and the obligation.
So opposing counsel says, well, all the definitions of usual and customary prices in the contracts vary from contract to contract. And I also asked, well, could the contract itself say that it doesn't include the RX savings program? And would that then be fraudulent? So in your theory, I guess, since we're not looking at the contracts, say that all of the contracts Rite Aid had with the PBMs except it excluded the RX savings program from usual and customary prices. Are you saying that their report of usual and customary prices would still be fraudulent and give you a basis for a claim?
Your Honor, you're saying if the contracts explicitly excluded?
Right.
Not sure the answer to that. I mean, here, that isn't the case.
But wouldn't you have to say that's necessarily fraudulent, because otherwise he wouldn't have a claim in the absence of a contract? So if there is some independent obligation to report usual and customary prices according to your definition, then even if the contract allowed him to exclude the RX savings, it would still be deceptive.
I mean, perhaps that's an issue for summary judgment, but in here what we're focused on with equitable estoppel is looking at, you know, does the complaint rely on the contract terms? Is it viable without reference to the contract? Here, again, where the plaintiff never even saw the contracts, the district court found claims were plausibly alleged without relying on the contract terms, is not seeking to hold Rite Aid liable for violating the terms of any contract. And where Rite Aid concedes that the contract itself doesn't rely on any contract, and that's why it's concocted this response to interrogatories as their only basis to show that there's some reliance on a contract.
I'm not sure that I'm not positive that I got an answer if I phrased the question in a way that phrased it properly. Is the definition of usual and customary price legally enforceable in this setting? And if so, by whom?
My understanding of the claims is that there's a common definition of usual and customary prices.
What's and that? Where are the usual and customary prices?
Industry standards. There's a welfare and institutions code provision which is cited in the complaint. It's a sort of there's a common knowledge of what usual and customary prices means, which means the lowest price, cash paying price. That's what usual and customary pricing means in the industry. And so the fact that Rite Aid did not use their RX savings program pricing in calculating the usual and customary prices meant that they were misrepresenting, overinflating the price.
What is the regulation you said it was, you relied upon, and was on welfare and institutions code? Is that what you said?
That's one of the sources that sort of demonstrates.
Let me put it this way. What is the best non-contractual source of the definition of usual and customary price from your perspective?
From the NCPDP.
From the what?
The National Council on Prescription Drug Programs, the industry standard, which defines it.
The National Council on what?
PDP, I think it's.
Is that an industry association? Do they have any legal status?
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. But it's sort of an industry widely as pled as the district court found. It was the widely accepted standard in the industry, and a common understanding of what usual and customary prices means.
Do either of my colleagues have additional questions for Mr. Love? If not, we thank you, Mr. Love. Ms. Schuster, you have some rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a few points. One, the California Welfare and Institution Code statute that Mr. Love just mentioned, on its face, applies a definition of usual and customary price only to submission for reimbursement, Medi-Cal claim submissions. It has no application to the private insurance transactions at issue here. Those are governed exclusively by contract. To answer Judge Ikuda's question, the NCPDP is an industry association. It is not a governmental body. And the existence of the industry standard that plaintiff alleges, that standard, if it exists, is not privately enforceable without an independent source of that obligation. There's no statute on point. Plaintiff has not identified one. The only source the plaintiff has identified are the contracts between Rite Aid and his insurance companies, or PBMs, and that's what requires the reporting of the usual and customary price. It's a defined contract term, and if the plaintiff is able to show deception, deceptive practices, which he said is sort of the key element to his claims, that can only be shown by a deviation from the contractual obligations. That's not
Schuster,
style.
What is your best argument that Rite Aid has not waived its right to arbitrate this claim?
Sure, Your Honor. I mean, aside from the fact that question has been delegated and is not proper for the court to resolve.
Well, that's for us to decide, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor, but I'd say under Supreme Court precedent, that question has been delegated. But I would say that a plaintiff who, like plaintiff here, affirmatively represented that he was not relying on contract terms in order to defeat a motion to dismiss, who refused to provide basic information to enable Rite Aid to identify which contracts were at issue or to verify his identity, and who obscured his identity with false allegations in the complaint, equitably cannot meet his very heavy burden to prove waiver. District Court found waiver based on finding that Rite Aid should have known about the existence of its arbitration right pre-discovery. But that is the wrong standard. Waiver is not forfeiture. Waiver must be an intentional relinquishment of a known right. And this court's precedents make clear, in particular the Royal Air case, that when waiver is predicated on inquiry notice, it's in facts of inquiry notice, is not intentional and therefore is not.
Well, Rite Aid certainly knew about this contract because it was a party.
It was not a party, Your Honor.
I'm sorry?
Rite Aid is also
not a party. Well, it's subsidiary, that it's wholly controlled, wholly owned subsidiary. It knew about it, and it relies upon it. Are you contending that Mr. Stafford knew about these contracts at the time that the lawsuit was filed?
Sure, Your Honor. So Rite Aid is not a signatory to the contracts. It's subsidiaries.
I think that's kind of a weak argument if you're relying on a wholly owned subsidiary as the basis for this.
Right. So the subsidiary had 95 pharmacy contracts over the relevant period. Mr. Stafford provided no information for us to whittle down from that which of the pharmacy contracts were relevant to his claims, much less determine if those contracts included arbitration provisions. Whether the plaintiff knew about the contracts in particular is not relevant to the equitable estoppel inquiry, but the complaint shows in particular at paragraph 32 that plaintiff is well aware that there are these contracts in the industry that define usual and customary price. He just didn't identify which specific contracts were relevant to his claims because he didn't give details of his claims.
Okay, let me ask my colleagues, do either of my colleagues have additional questions of Ms. Schuster?
I just have one. So on the issue of the delegation clause, so just so I understand your position as a district judge, this is the kind of issue I think about. Your position is that the district court has no role. A lawsuit is filed, somebody brings in an agreement that has a delegation clause, and the district judge has no role in deciding whether it whether the parties have an agreement to arbitrate.
That's not our position. Once the court finds...
What is the role of the district judge?
The court's role when there's a delegation clause is to determine, first, is there a contract? And that's what equitable estoppel resolves here. And then second, is there a delegation clause? If there's a delegation clause, that's where the district court's role ends under Supreme Court's decisions interpreting the division of authority between arbitrators and courts under the Federal Arbitration Act. So the court determines, is there a contract? And then does that contract contain a delegation clause? The answer to both questions are yes. The court has to compel arbitration. Lax discretion.
Are you relying on the incorporation of the rules, the AAA and AHLA rules for the delegation clause?
Yes, we are, Your Honor.
But what's the Supreme Court case that you say takes the district court out of the second step because of delegation?
The most recent case is Henry Schein. That was a case where the Fifth Circuit had, in the face of a delegation clause, said it wasn't going to delegate because it thought the argument was wholly groundless. And the Supreme Court rejected that and said, even if you think it's wholly groundless, even if you disagree with the argument, the question is for the arbitrator to decide, not the court, when there is a delegation clause.
That's once the court determines that there is a contract, right?
Correct.
Am I remembering correctly that in Schein there was also a reliance on the rules, on the reference to the rules?
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's what I thought. Okay.
Other questions by my colleague? Thanks to both counsel for your argument in this case. The case just argued of Stafford versus Rite Aid Corporation is now submitted.